Bit of a background in this where maybe I can share a few stories with you of what's taken place over the years. We're going to start with a general overview that starts with the anatomy and physiology. Infants are obligate nose breathers, meaning that they have to breathe through their nose. They can't open their mouth to breathe. They do have a lot of difficulty with nippling, nursing, or feeding when they are congested. And you'll see them get very fussy. They'll pull away and just look like they're fighting the bottle. They only breathe through their mouth when they're crying. They do have minimal mucus production, which makes them susceptible to infection. They only have maxillary and ethmoid sinuses.
Do you want to
share my screen? Okay, there we go, how about that? All right, so the sinuses develop later, the frontal sinus here, around the adolescent years. And y'all know why we have sinuses. It's because our head would be so heavy, we wouldn't be able to hold it up if we didn't have the air spaces in there. All right, so their tongues are very big in comparison to what it would be as they grow. Their tonsils and adenoids are very large. Adenoids are located at the very back of the nose back here. So you can imagine if they're swollen and the tonsils are, the difficulty with breathing. Y'all, does anybody have your little pen light where it has the size of the eye, the pupils? Look at that at the 4 millimeter. The pen is about 4 milliliters. And if you look at that, so their airways are smaller than your pinky finger, okay? An adult is 20 millimeters. Even when they have mild edema, mucus and lines the airway, and then they can have bronchospasms, and it leads to airway compromise and increased work of breathing really quickly in a small child. Plus, their neck muscles are underdeveloped, and they have really chubby, thick, fat necks. So you can imagine that there's going to be some compression on the airway from that as well. This is a picture from your book that shows the difference. If you have just 1 millimeter, and think how small that is, 1 millimeter of airway swelling creates half the volume of air that can go through that airway. So you can see that that does create a real problem right off the bat. So they talk about the bifurcation of the trachea. You know, our biggest airway is right here from our mouth as you open your mouth and suck air in. So that's the beginning of your airway. It goes into the trachea. It does start dividing, or bifurcating is the fancy word for that, at the third thoracic vertebrae. Lower airway obstruction secondary to bronchiolitis, asthma, or foreign body. Yes, ma'am. Okay. So in a child, their chest wall is very compliant, meaning that it moves very easily. Their diaphragm does all the work moving the air up and down. Okay. Ooh, yay. Look at there. We are actually fancy.
And turn it off when you're done.
Okay. All right. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome.
When their lungs get hyperinflated, that's, if you can imagine taking a breath and you get a certain amount in and less out, and then the next breath you get the same amount in and less out. Eventually, your lungs are hyperinflated. That does happen with asthma. It's called an obstructive airway disorder. They lose the ability for the diaphragm to rise and fall. They do have a very high metabolic rate. So our oxygen demand is 6 to 8 liters. Ours is 3 to 4 liters per minute, where an infant is 6 to 8. So theirs is almost double ours. And they do have hypoxia that onsets very rapidly. The hemoglobin is the carrier. Remember I told you UPS and FedEx? So hemoglobin carries the oxygen, and a normal oxygen saturation is greater than 97%. So on our physical exam, we always will go in this order, and we're gonna have a lot of disorders to talk about, so just keep this in mind. We're inspection and observation, auscultation, percussion, and palpation. Overall appearance, they should look, you know, cool and calm. If they look distressed, that's a certain clue right there. Are they restless, anxious, tachypneic, or grunting? Do they have an increased work of breathing? Any kind of nasal flaring, that's probably the first thing that you're going to see, and it's very easy to detect. Accessory muscle use, you'll see that in the chest before you will anywhere else. Once you see it here, it's a real sign of trouble. Are they head bobbing? You know, they think about an athlete when they've just gotten through running a race and their head's kind of bobbing every breath that they take. You'll see a child do that as well. Tripod sitting is where they're kind of leaning forward a little bit, and they've got their hands down so that the weight of their shoulders does not have to be lifted by the expansion of the chest. So it's an unconscious gesture that they do. Sometimes they'll do pursed lip breathing, but I've never seen that in a child. What do they look like color-wise? Are they pale or are they cyanotic? A lot of times you'll see circumoral, meaning just around the mouth, cyanosis, but then you can also see central cyanosis, which is going to be more on the chest. A lot of times in children, you'll see bluish-tinged hands and feet. That typically is more related to cardiac function than it is to respiratory function, but it's certainly possible to see that in respiratory dysfunction as well. The degree of cyanosis is not always indicative of how bad they are so far as their respiratory status. We do need to establish their hydration status. Like I said, if they can't eat, then they're going to get dehydrated pretty quickly because they live on liquids at this age. We do have to hydrate them as needed, and oral may be a problem at that point, so you're probably going to have to get you an IV going. Clubbing, there is a picture on page 1411. I think I have it here for you on the next slide. There we go. That's what clubbing looks like. You can tell that's an old person's hands, but that's what clubbing looks like. It occurs with chronic respiratory illness. Your book doesn't tell you this, but it can also be due to circulatory issues. So that would be cardiac. Increased capillary growth as the body attempts to supply oxygen to the most distal part of the body. You think about if you were to hold your arms and feet out, how far your heart has to go. Yes, ma'am. This is respiratory in general. Yeah, the question was, is this specific to asthma? No, this is specific to respiratory disorders of all kinds in small children, okay? We will talk about asthma. Unfortunately, it's almost all the way to the end. There's our clubbing picture. So we will palpate sinuses for tenderness in the older child, of course. Lymph nodes, you have lymph nodes all around, starting here at your ears, coming behind your ears, under your jawline, up underneath your chin. And then you have what's called the anterior cervical chain, which is here in front of that sternocleidomastoid muscle. The posterior cervical chain is behind that, okay? We will feel for fimitus in the chest. Some of the things that your book doesn't talk about, if you lightly rest your hands on someone's back and you have them say 99, you can feel the vibration, okay? And that's normal. If there is no vibration, there's a consolidated mass in there, which is usually just mucus. Then there's E to A changes too. And as you listen with your stethoscope, if you have them say E, it will sound like an A when you listen through the stethoscope. If the fremitus is increased, like the vibration is much more than you expect, then that's because of a pneumothorax, which is air. And air, of course, allows vibration of the tissue much easily. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question
after this. Okay.
So
their book said that it's actually increased with pneumonia and pleural effusions, and it said that it's absent
with the pneumothorax in the book.
We'd have to look back at that, because I think that that's the opposite.
Okay.
Okay. So let's keep that. I'll look back at that and give y'all an answer after lecture. How does that sound?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So on percussion, if it is consolidated with a pneumonia, it will be dull to percussion. Percussion is actually pretty fun to perform on a patient. They always think it's very interesting. You're going to rest your hand very lightly on them, and you're going to tap on your own finger rather than tapping on their chest wall. Okay? So you tap, 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 and you keep as little of your hand in contact with their chest wall as possible to make it as accurate as possible. Tympany occurs with a pneumothorax and hyperresonance with asthma. Bilateral breath sounds should be clear throughout. Document diminished breath sounds. Inspiratory is usually softer and longer than expiratory phase. A prolonged expiratory phase is due to an obstruction, like in bronchiolitis, asthma, or with a foreign body aspiration. Infants do have a thin chest wall, so their breathing does seem very loud sometimes, and it's especially loud if mucus is present. When possible, if you're hearing a lot of airway noise, have the child cough and then auscultate again. If the sound truly is coming from the lungs, it won't go away. But if you have them cough and the sound is gone, then it's in the upper airways. And that's called referred upper airway noise. Wheezing is a high-pitched expiratory sound. It's heard on the expiratory phase, and it represents obstruction in the lower airway. If it goes away with a cough, it usually is just caused by mucus that is lining the airway. Rails or crackles are from fluid-filled sacs in the alveoli. And it sounds like a popping. And if you have hair long enough to hold it in front of your ear, if you just take and rub your hair in front of your ear, that is exactly what crackle sounds like. Increased heart rate and hypoxia occur quickly in kids. So there are some charts that you can take a look at, page 1412 and 1413. And I don't want you to review everything that's on those two charts, but just these things that are listed here. Nursing actions, we do want to position the child to open the airway. That you see in the picture is called a sniff. We are kind of the head tilt, chin lift, but we are just putting their head back to open the airway. They are supine, and we can also elevate the head of the bed in an older child. We do try to humidify the air. It helps the secretions not get too thick and sticky. We'll suction if necessary, and if we're going to do that to the nose, we're going to try to use nasal saline drops first. When you do suction, you want to point the tip of the suction device towards the outside corner of the eye, so you're not suctioning the septum. If you suction on the septum, it's going to make it swell, and it'll make the swelling in the nose worse. And so if you're using nose spray on yourself, you're going to use opposite hands, and you're going to insert as far as possible, point to the outside corner. So if you always think about pointing to the outside corner, when you go to suction a baby, you'll have it at the right angle. Okay? Encourage coughing to clear the airway. Do CPT when it's called for, and that's usually only used for a CF patient. Watch for fatigue. This does happen. Their respiratory muscles can fatigue, which will lead to bradypnea, and eventually extreme tachycardia, and you'll see some nasal flaring with that, as well as accessory muscle use, along with a prolonged expiratory phase. When they start getting worn out, you gotta start watching what's gonna happen with that heart, because usually respiratory distress, if it advances, it causes cardiac issues. Reassess frequently to detect deterioration early. Allow adequate rest periods to conserve energy. Administer the antibiotics as ordered. Teach and encourage incentive spirometry. You don't see that used very often in kids, but they need it just as much. Administer the oxygen. And remember that oxygen is considered a drug. I always thought that was so funny. But oxygen is considered a drug. You have to have an order for it. There are usually protocols in place that give you the leeway to make the decision what needs to be done. If you need to up the flow rate or change the method of delivery, use bronchodilators. That's got to be inhaled medications, and decrease anxiety, and involve the family if you can. So nursing actions, look for the mental status changes, such as confusion, lethargy, any kind of restlessness or combativeness. Excuse me, those are all kind of changes in LOC that occur due to hypoxia. Maintain the hydration status like we talked about, especially if they are NPO. Weigh them daily, promote rest. They do need small frequent meals. Gradual activity increases is tolerated. Use play to gain cooperation and trust, and again, involve the parents. There's some charts that talk about the common medications. Oxygen, of course, we want humidity, suction, and CPT. The most common drugs that you're gonna see used, expectorants and cough suppressants. Really, cough suppressants are discouraged, but your book does say that they are used. Oxygen is discussed, usually administered by the respiratory therapist. But you need to keep in mind that that respiratory therapist treating that child is acting under your delegation, okay? There are actually separate orders for that respiratory therapist to do what they're doing, but ultimately you are responsible for what they are doing as well. There will probably be a unit protocol for emergency actions, and like I said, you're responsible. There's different places where you can connect, the wall versus portable. Portable runs out very quickly, but it does make it possible for that child to get up and mobile a little bit. The delivery device varies a little bit as well. Nasal cannula, of course, is going to be the most common, and then mask. And they do tend to fight that. And even if the nasal cannula is not truly in the nose, as long as it's in the vicinity, they're still getting a lot of it. The child still does have to breathe. And of course, we talked about humidity. So acute infectious disorders, we're going to get started on the infectious disorders, and this is the common cold. The common cold is viral, is also called a URI or nasopharyngitis. is caused by that list of viruses, the rhinovirus, parainfluenza, RSV, enterovirus, adenovirus, and there's more. It's spread through air from person to person. Typically occurs during the winter months. It occurs more often in kids that go to daycare or school. The good thing is that makes their immune system tough as nails, right? So we are not discouraging that, even though we're saying that that is a potential cause. Typically, kids have as many as 9 a year, and they last about 10 or 12 days. So you think about that, it's a lot. Kids are sick a lot. They do spontaneously resolve. So we do give them supportive care for symptom relief. If a secondary infection occurs, it's typically an ear infection, throat infection, or sinus. Mucus is not really diagnostic, although typically we use that. Once the mucus goes from that clear watery to the thick yellow and even green tinged, that's when you say it's turned into an infection, and that's when you start antibiotics. They typically want you to wait 5 days before you give antibiotics to a child. Promote comfort, we'll use the saline drops, humidifier, liquids, lozenges. We'll use Tylenol or acetaminophen for pain as a fever reducer. But we do try to avoid that as much as possible. If you can wipe them down with a cool wash rag, give them something cold to drink, fan their clothes, take the blankets off, that's a better way to reduce the fever. And remember, fever is actually our friend. We want them to have a little bit of fever, okay? Fever is our body's way of killing the germ that's making us sick. So we will teach prevention as well, hand washing and avoiding secondhand smoke, close contacts with anybody that might be sick, and remember, no antibiotics because this is a viral infection. So complications, prolonged fever, increased pain, especially if they're complaining now of something new, okay? Headache, sore throat, facial pain, earache, and swollen lymph nodes that are painful in the neck. We are concerned if it lasts more than 10 days, if their cough is worse than it has been, if they start getting irritable and lethargic, or if they have any kind of new skin rash after several days. So let's move on to sinusitis. It is bacterial. Acute is less than 30 days. Can y'all imagine a sinus infection for 30 days? That's a long time. Chronic is if it's more than 30. It includes mucosal swelling. There's decreased ciliary movement. You think about our airways are lined with little cilia, the little teeny tiny hairs that move things that they don't like out of their way, okay? So that's why we're constantly, that cough is, secretions are being made, they're being moved up. That movement is reduced when you're sick. Antibiotics are typically used for 14 days. Chronic cases require surgery. They create windows in the sinuses and also remove polyps if they're there. So symptoms of a sinus infection are listed there for you: the cough, fever, facial pain, eyelid swelling, poor appetite, irritability. So the findings look the same as for a cold, but they also include the postnasal drip, erythema, and halitosis. The diagnosis can be made using a sinus x-ray. A CBC is usually not very helpful because our sinuses don't communicate with the blood. So your white blood cell count does not go up in relationship or response to a sinus infection. Here we go, we're talking about flu now. It is viral. It happens during the winter months for the most part, from October to March. It is transmitted by droplet. Children shed the virus 1 to 2 days prior to experiencing any kind of symptoms. So y'all think about that related to COVID, and you know, everybody's walking around perfectly fine, and then crash and boom, they're sick as a dog, right? And so that's what happens with flu as well. So they are contagious, shedding the virus and passing along before they ever develop symptoms, and then they shed it for as much as 2 weeks after having had the flu. 10 to 40% of children affected annually. That number varies very widely because of the effectiveness of the flu vaccine. We start the flu vaccine at 6 months. So, and it does change depending on what age group you're in. Chronic condition predisposes children to more severe cases of influenza. Secondary infections are common in kids and include pneumonia, otitis, and in rare cases, acute myositis. And that's where they have pain in their calves, and they'll actually run around on their tiptoes because their calves hurt so bad. Prolonged fever or a relapse indicates a need for a further workup. So it's not uncommon to have a secondary infection from the flu. The ones that are more prone to have it are the ones that are, again, back in daycare and school. Their symptoms are a very abrupt onset. Temperature usually is more than 39.5 Celsius. They have flushing, chills, headache, body aches. They're just laying around tired, they're coughing, and they have the coryza, which is just a fancy word for congestion, cold symptoms, okay? And half of them will have a sore throat, some photophobia, and eye pain. Watch for a toxic appearance and irritability. The treatment is just supportive because it is a viral illness. They do have some antiviral medications now that were not listed in your book that can be used. I'm not sure how young you can start, like Tamiflu. That's the most common one. I think it's at 2 years old. Pharyngitis is an inflammation of the throat, and it's usually due to a viral or bacterial infection. Strep is 20 to 30% of the time the cause. Keep in mind that sometimes kids can become carriers. So if we're using the rapid strep test and it comes back positive, if they are a carrier, it's going to show up positive, even if they're not actually experiencing a strep infection in their throat. If you do a rapid test, y'all may be familiar with that. Those are tests that are done in a clinic setting that they can get the results back in a few minutes. It's usually 5 to 10 minutes. And they're right 90% of the time. So it's a great way to check for that. But if you do get a negative and you really think it should have been positive, you can send a swab off for a culture, and it takes a couple of days to get results on that. But it may be positive. And if you're just really convinced that it's a strep infection, even though your test is negative, you can go ahead and do antibiotics at that point. They may experience peritonsillar or retropharyngeal abscesses. It is, in most cases, if it's not strep, it is viral and it is self-limiting. Bacterial infections require antibiotics. Penicillin is the number one choice right there. If you're allergic, the other ones are listed there, macrolides and cephalosporins. So strep classic symptoms, they do have sudden fever or a sudden onset with fever, sore throat, and difficulty swallowing, headache, and abdominal pain. And I think the abdominal pain just comes from the infection that they're swallowing as their tonsils are infected. Inspect the oropharynx for inflammation and swelling. If you see petechiae on the soft palate, that's called the hallmark sign. If you see that, you don't even have to run the strep test. Y'all know what petechiae is, right? The little tiny, fine red dots. You start, if you were to reach into your mouth, you've got the hard palate first, and as you go back further, that's the soft palate there. And so just before the uvula, you're gonna see those little tiny red dots. A strawberry tongue and strep breath. And let me tell you, that is distinctive. Once you've smelled it, you know what it is when you walk in the room. They will have tender anterior cervical chain nodes here. They have the red sandpapery itchy rash. If it progresses, that's called scarlatiniform. It's on the trunk and the abdomen. We can do the rapid strep, and like I said, send it off for a culture if it's negative. Only an additional, this is tonsillitis here, but only things in addition to pharyngitis that you need to see is if it is recurrent, they will need to have their tonsils out. The adenoids are typically taken out at the same time. Remember, they're at the back of the nose. 4+ tonsils are called kissing tonsils. They do touch, and they may block the airway completely. They commonly snore with big tonsils, and hypertrophic tonsils are different than a tonsil infection. They'll take those out as well. After surgery, you're going to see a lot of dry blood in the mouth and teeth, and it's common to kind of cough up blood and chunks of dry blood for several days after that. That's very concerning to the patient and the parent. So here we are, we're talking about mono, and you hit like my little kissing monkey there, because mono is known as the kissing disease, okay? It's caused by the Epstein-Barr virus. It is self-limiting, although it lasts forever. It includes fever, malaise, sore throat, and lymph node enlargement. And this is where you're gonna see posterior cervical node enlargement, so that's back here. You can see it in both, but if you have it back here, most of the time that's mono. It is a kissing disease. It's contracted through wet oropharyngeal secretions. So you think about how teenagers share, that they'll take a sip of their Coke and pass it to their friend. It might go to 2 or 3 people before they decide that's enough. Sometimes will occur at the same time with strep. The spleen rupture is a possibility. That is definitely a complication. So do not palpate. It says in your book to palpate, but you do not want to palpate the spleen. It may be followed by Guillain-Barre and aseptic meningitis, but that does rarely occur. You have to avoid any kind of contact sports because of the potential for the spleen to rupture. And the management is supportive. There would be no antibiotics for this. So you have two phases with mono. The acute phase, when you're experiencing all those symptoms, and then for as much as 4 months, a prolonged phase where you're just wiped out. Have any of y'all ever had mono? No, no, oh yeah, I get a few head nods here. Yeah, it's awful. So laryngitis, that is an inflammation of the larynx. Typically, it occurs in conjunction with other respiratory illnesses, like a cold or a sore throat. But it is a standalone illness. It can be completely separate from anything else. It is a hoarseness or a complete loss of the voice. It usually lasts less than 24 hours, and the throat is not necessarily sore. You know, when you hear somebody screeching, they're like, where's that? You think it has to be killing their throat, but they'll tell you, no, it's not hurting at all. So croup, here's our little seal. Did any of y'all look at the pigmonix on the computer, on the point, and watch the little croup pigmonic? Oh, I wanted to add it here, but I didn't think we'd have enough time. Y'all be sure and see that, because it is about 3 minutes long, and it takes you through the entire croup diagnosis and treatment. And it's cute. It's very memorable. So it happens 3 months to 3 years. It is also called laryngotracheobronchitis. That just means that it's all involved. It's called by the parainfluenza virus. It leads to a narrowing of the airway. And remember how tiny it is to begin with, no bigger around this than your pen. It can cause audible inspiratory stridor. That's usually the first symptom. You'll hear your child in the other room, like that. It has a barky cough. It's worse at night. It is self-limiting, though it does need a lot of supportive care. We use steroids for this. That's oral steroids as well as inhaled, if you can get them down them. And then racemic epi as well. And that's just epinephrine that's breathed in through a nebulized treatment. Parents typically first report the cough during the night. It is diagnosed based on the history and clinical presentation. So there's not like a test, like the strep test, where you go in there and you swab them and you run it through the machine. There's no test. It's just going by the history. You can do a lateral neck x-ray, and you may actually see what's called a steeple sign. And so as you look from this direction, sometimes the airway will have swollen enough that you get a distinctive steeple look. There's a little bit of reading you do in your book there. So safety. This is just me. Anytime a nebulized medication has to be used, close monitoring is required because they may rebound, and retreatment can be done. And I didn't put like numbers on here because it varies depending on which medication you're using. But commonly the rescue medication being used is albuterol. It has a lot of different names like ProAir and Ventolin. But that can be given about every 15 minutes for as many as 3 in a row. You think about what you're gonna be doing to that heart rate too though, okay? Because it just jacks the heart rate through the roof. And it makes you feel very panicky when you use albuterol, okay? So repeated treatments can be done. The beta cells in the lungs are like a sponge. Picture one of those big bone-looking sponges that you wash your car with. If you put that in the bucket of water and you pull it out and it's completely saturated with soapy water and you put it back in the bucket, how much more is that sponge gonna absorb? Nothing, right? So once our beta cells in the lungs get saturated, you will not absorb any more of that medication. You could administer as long as you want to, continuous, but they're not going to absorb any more medicine. This is when you see a mild asthma patient or someone who normally doesn't have much of a problem die. And it does happen. You'll hear about hunters in the woods that have their inhaler in their hand and they're dead from asthma in the woods. It's because they just kept ignoring the symptoms until it was too late. And they just kept hitting that inhaler and eventually it doesn't work. If you do have to do a third bronchodilator treatment, you have to call 911 or immediately go. And you make that decision just based on how bad off that kid is at that point in time. epiglottitis. You guessed it, it's the swelling of the epiglottis. So a lot of these are similar, okay? So you're gonna see that. It's associated with H flu type B, which is prevented with the HIV vaccine. The airway may become occluded. This child will be in the PICU. The management is airway maintenance. We do have to have IV antibiotics because it is bacterial. Do not try to visualize the oropharynx or make the child cry. Okay, don't make that child cry for any reason. You don't give him a shot. You don't, you know, walk in and try to talk to him and scare him to death and make him cry. They will have a toxic appearance. They have a high fever. They'll sit forward with their neck extended because they're trying to get air in. They have a deer in the headlight look, okay? They're panicked and they feel it. Do not leave that child unattended. It is very scary, so keep the parents calm. They are the ones that can keep their child calm. You're gonna be given oxygen at 100%. An emergency tracheostomy may be required. Make sure that you have a setup at the bedside to do so. And you need to make sure that the PALS certified people that are in the hospital are in the loop and know that you have that patient in the PICU so that they're prepared to respond if necessary. Bronchiolitis, yep, inflammation of the bronchioles and the small bronchi. So this is almost always viral. It typically is RSV, which is a highly contagious virus. It happens in the winter and spring, so that's the RSV season. The RSV infection, almost 100% occur when you know that it's RSV in the first few years of life. We all get RSV. We probably all have an RSV infection at least once a year, okay? But when it happens in a small child, it is a big deal, okay? So the younger they are, the worse it is. So there is that correlation. You see it here, the severity inversely relates to age. So the younger they are, the worse it is. This has swelling in the airway, letting less air out, leads to hyperinflation and atelectasis. So atelectasis is nothing more than a pancaking down of lung tissue, okay? You think about some old person that's laid up in the bed, that's been sick, and they are just shallow breathing because they're not doing anything that creates the need to take a bigger, deeper breath, right? So their lung tissue will collapse down. That does happen in this as well. The only way to open that back up is with good deep breathing. So air trapping causes serious impairment in gas exchange and causes them to really work hard to breathe. So our care would be supportive. We would provide oxygen, suctioning if necessary, hydration, because remember they're not going to be taking anything in. They are working so hard to breathe that they cannot manage taking anything in. We use bronchodilators. They do deteriorate very quickly. If we are managing them at home, it would have to be a very mild case, but the parents need to know the signs and symptoms of worsening and when to go. So bronchiolitis continued, we will assess. This is another one that you just don't have a test for other than RSV. And as you get older, they don't even run the RSV test. Have y'all ever had an RSV test run on you? No, you know, it's because they don't feel like it's necessary because it's so common. In adults, it just causes cold symptoms. Typically they'll have coryza, pharyngitis, LFT, I'm not sure. Cough would last 1 to 3 days prior to the onset of the wheeze. The history predisposes them to worst cases would be if they were premature or if they were one of a multiple birth or if they were born in the months of April through September, because that puts them at a very young age when RSV season hits. If they have a chronic lung disease, of course, it would make it worse. Males seem to catch it a little bit more and have worse cases. Again, if they go to daycare or school or if they have a school-age sibling, sorry. If they have low SES, and I'm not sure the tie-in to that, if they are not breastfed, and exposure to secondhand smoke also predisposes them to this as well. So our exam is the same as other respiratory illnesses. They will be anxious because they are air hungry. They'll be breathing very fast. They'll be using accessory muscles They will have periods of apnea possibly as well. There's an audible wheeze potential for sure. They may be cyanotic. They could have retractions. Grunting, and grunting is a way of keeping the airway open. You can imagine, just picture yourself doing it. When you do it and you feel it, you can tell that it is a way of keeping the airway open. They don't know that they're doing that. It's not a conscious thing that they do, but it is a way to keep the airway open if they have the cough or if they are listless. If they are uninterested in feedings, their surrounding or their parents, that's a real hallmark sign and a sign for concern. So our auscultation, number one, is there good excursion there? That just means are they really taking good deep breaths? You can't instruct a baby to take a good deep breath, but you can expect to see it happen. Wheezes may be scattered, but they may be so tight that you don't hear a wheeze. And so this is one of those cases where when you give a breathing treatment, they suddenly sound so much worse. And everybody is convinced that the breathing treatment harmed them or that, you know, that they're going downhill. But what happens is they're so tight that you can't hear anything rattling around or wheezing around. And so you give that breathing treatment and it does create that wheeze. And you do expect it to get better over time, but you're going to see it worse before you see it better in that case. The diagnosis, we use a pulse ox, a chest x-ray. You'll see hyperinflated lungs as well as the atelectasis. They talk about blood gases. Tell you the truth, I've never seen a blood gas done on a patient. Maybe if they were in the PICU, you would see that done. They do the nasal pharyngeal wash to collect the specimen. And that's pretty difficult to do. You're putting a lot of saline in and trying to suck it all out at the same time. And they're fighting you tooth and nail the whole time. And you've got a baby whose airway is already swollen and compromised. So it's a real tricky matter. Management, in most cases, it is self-limiting, and we do supportive care. Fluids are really important, antipyretics, and observation. We will keep the head of the bed elevated if possible and support the airway. You have to have suction at the bedside. So I think all of y'all that have been with me to Ochsner or LSU have had the opportunity to see that set up. And anytime you suspect that there's going to be a problem, you don't wait until there's a problem, then go to the storage room and try to find the supplies that you need. You've got that set up. You've already got it connected, where all you have to do is use it. So we will use oxygen, steroids, and bronchodilators to treat them. So a few loose ends on bronchiolitis. There is the immunization. It's called Synagis. But it has to be started at a certain time, and they're only going to use it for the babies that they think are really susceptible, like the multiple births or the premature babies, and the ones that are born that April to, I forget the months, April through September. We do have to educate the family and identify high-risk babies so that we can only give the vaccine to the high-risk babies. On pneumonia, this is an inflammation in the lung parenchyma. The causes are viral, bacterial, mycoplasma, or fungal. So you've got four different causes. Most likely two are viral and bacterial. The viral is usually pretty well tolerated. Bacterial is pretty bad. Remember, in our meningitis, the bacterial was bad. Well, bacterial is bad in this one as well, okay? So they may have a toxic appearance, but they typically do recover pretty rapidly. Streptococcus and M. pneumonia are the two most common bacterial pathogens. And infants and toddlers, aspiration is a big concern, you know, because they put a lot of things in their mouth. And then, of course, they're taking a lot of liquids in. And there's a lot to coordinate in taking a bottle down or nursing. It typically occurs in winter and spring months as well. If it is viral, it's usually self-limiting. Y'all get that expression, right? It just kind of quits on its own eventually. Recurrent pneumonia infections may indicate a chronic disease. And this may be where you actually diagnose a patient, okay? Used to, when I started out in Peds Pulmonary at LSU, CF was not in the panel for newborns, the newborn screen. So that was one of the ways that we often diagnosed a CF patient. We'll talk about CF again, I'll get in a little bit. The complications to pneumonia, you can have bacteremia, a pleural effusion, empyema, is that fancy word for just a pus pocket in the lung fields or in the space, the pleural space, you can have a lung abscess or a pneumothorax. The treatment in this case is going to be antipyretics, hydration, and supportive care. If they are hospitalized, they usually require oxygen, IV hydration, and IV antibiotics. So the bad cases are the ones that you're going to see. The bad are the bacterial, right? Pneumonia a lot of times follows an upper respiratory infection. It has fever, cough, an increased respiratory rate, lethargy and poor feeding, chills, chest pain, nausea and vomiting. I've not seen the nausea and vomiting as a complaint with a pneumonia, but you can imagine the chest pain, they do complain about that. And usually if you have somebody that's complaining of pain in their chest and they've got a lot of these symptoms, it's gonna be a pneumonia. Another thing that kind of clues you in on that too is if the breath sounds are different from one side to the other. You know, with our auscultation, the pattern that we've taught you of how you go about doing your auscultation where you go from one side to the other and then drop down and back, or whatever pattern that you've adopted, it's important to do the comparison from one side to the other. And listen in all fields too. The physical exam will also include wheezes, and then rails is just crackles again, dullness, and they may have increased fremitus. So diagnostic tests that you can use, the pulse ox number one, chest x-ray, a sputum culture, and a CBC. Sometimes they'll also do a blood culture. The CBC, if it is bacterial, should be really elevated. The chest x-ray may show infiltrates, which is just a collection of inflammatory cells, cellular debris, or any kind of foreign body that the child might have ingested. And it says foreign organisms here as well. The care is supportive, antibiotics when appropriate. We'll teach the expectations that it will last 1 to 2 weeks, with the cough lasting as much as 3 weeks after the resolve of the pneumonia. And we will immunize with the pneumococcal vaccine. Okay, so you're going to hear immunize, immunize, immunize. It's very important. So bronchitis is an inflammation of the trachea and major bronchi associated with an upper respiratory infection. It's usually viral. 10% of cases are pneumonia. They usually recover in 5 days with supportive care. Chest x-rays are going to show alveolar or hyperinflation and perihilar markings. Care is supportive. Discourage the use of cough suppressants. That accumulated sputum needs to come up and get gone. Guaifenesin is good. That's a mucus thinner. And it helps smooth the secretions a little bit better. Decongestants are good too. They need to be used limited amounts because decongestants can actually dry out your airways, which will make it harder to move the mucus and make you stay sick longer. And the longer you are sick with something like this, the more likely it is it's going to turn into a secondary infection. And we want to try to avoid that as much as possible. So when we talk about supportive care, it really is important that they're getting their rest, they're getting their fluids, that they're running a little bit of fever. You know, we want that little bit of fever, not a whole lot, but a little bit. Tuberculosis, and I thought that was cute. Oh my Lord, they've turned into pillows. So think about people in close contact, okay? That's what this is supposed to represent, is somebody that's incarcerated, okay? Because that's where you do see it transmitted from person to person here in the United States. There are other countries that it is a little bit more common, and you're gonna see it passed in households more than you do here. But it is highly contagious, and it is due to the N. tuberculosis germ. It is from close contact. It takes 2 to 10 weeks for the incubation phase, meaning once you were exposed until you develop a symptom, but you may never develop symptoms. So you might have gotten exposed and have it latent. So you've got two different forms of TB in the chest, and that's latent and active. Symptoms are fever, malaise, weight loss, anorexia, pain, chest tightness, and hemoptysis. So they're gonna be, you know, coughing up blood. But you always hear TB associated with night sweats. So where's the night sweats? I don't talk about that at all, okay? That's not listed in your book as a symptom. So since we are talking about pediatric patients, that's probably the difference. The kids are not gonna have the night sweats. It's not going to be on your test, so don't worry about making sure you know that. But I thought that was very interesting because anytime you talk about TB, you've got that cough that lasts for a long time and night sweats. Everybody talks about that. So it causes inflammation. And the bacilli spread by bloodstream into other parts of the body through the lymphatic system. So you can actually have TB of any kind of part of your body, okay? It's very rare, but it does happen. It is drug-sensitive TB. If it is, you need to use these drugs listed there. The diagnostic test is the Mannitux. You know, they always want us to test for TB, you know, if you're going to be in nursing school. Now they're recommending that we only have the one test. And then after that, if it's negative, not even retest them. So isn't that interesting? The high-risk groups are going to be those with HIV, if they are incarcerated. And y'all, that's the first question. If somebody comes in and you're suspecting TB, you say, let me just ask, have you ever been in jail? You'd be surprised. If they have a known latent status, so if they knew that they had exposure to TB and they had a positive skin test and they have that latent status, they are at high risk to convert into active status. If they're immigrant, because it is more prevalent in other countries, if they're an illicit drug user because it can be passed by the needle use, migrant farm workers, and nursing home residents. And that's just that close contact again, okay? The care is supportive, and we do encourage them to adhere to the regimen of medications. Those three antibiotics that are listed there are not without side effects, and it's not pleasant, the treatment is not. And just because of the population of adults that have TB, you're gonna have a lot of non-compliance. You know, they're gonna be the ones living on the streets, and they're not gonna be wanting to come in. They actually make them come in, you know, for compliance. And you've even seen people jailed so that they will comply with TB treatment. That's how serious this is. But I don't think we would have those problems in children because we have the ability to make the determination that they will or will not take the medicine. We have to make sure that they have adequate nutrition, rest, and that we prevent exposure of them to someone else. If they are in the hospital setting, they will be isolated. So, we're fixing to start epistaxis. So, the anterior septum is what you're gonna see bleeding. So the septum is the divider between the two sides of the nose, and the anterior portion would be kind of close to the tip. That's usually the part that's bleeding. It is benign, unless they have an underlying bleeding disorder. We have to be calm and reassure the child and the parent. We would put pressure on it, just kind of grasping it here and holding it. You can use a cold rag or ice. It helps also to drink something a little bit cold. If it is recurrent, we would call it idiopathic. Sorry, I'm telling you wrong. It can be recurrent, and it usually is idiopathic. It usually is from picking the nose. If they have it, we do want them to lean forward because we don't want them to aspirate the blood, and they breathe through their mouth. And it typically resolves in 10 to 15 minutes. Foreign body aspiration. Inhaled foreign object, and it can be life-threatening. And it can be something just as innocuous as like a coin that's on the floor, and that child, up to 3 years old, they're really bad about putting things in their mouth and can easily aspirate and foreign body. If surgical removal is needed, we will use post-op antibiotics. You'll notice that child has a sudden onset of cough, wheeze, and stridor. Everything will be perfectly fine, and all of a sudden they're crashing over there. Auscultation, you'll hear a wheeze or even absent breath sounds in the affected area. So if it's falling down through the bronchus into one particular area, there will be one particular area that has no breath sound whatsoever. You can see it on x-ray if it is something that is radio opaque, okay? Not everything is. The key is prevention. Some of the things that they choke on or suck into their airway is peanuts, popcorn, and small toys. And so keep in mind that you wanna chop carrots, grapes, and hot dogs because that's also something that they will suck into their airway very easily. Ards. I want you to think peat. That's why there's a little chick down there on your screen. Follows sepsis, okay? So acute respiratory distress syndrome. And this is super scary. It is, or it could follow a viral pneumonia, smoke inhalation, or a near drowning. Pulmonary edema leads to a decreased surfactant production and causes the lung to be stiff, and that'll cause atelectasis. So it's a little chain of events that takes place there. It may cause residual lung problems, depending on how long it lasts and how severe it was. Most of the time, children recover. The worst case scenario is that they can die from it. So PEEP is positive end expiratory pressure. We have to maintain that. And think about a CPAP machine. That's the type of way that we would maintain it, not the exact same thing. But you would hear high-pitched crackles in this case, and this child would be in the PICU. So think PEEP with ARDS. A pneumothorax. This is just a collection of air in the pleural space. So the outside of our lungs have a lining around them, and then outside of that lining is the lining that is the lining of our chest wall. So you've got this lining that is a pleural space, and so that's where this pneumothorax would occur. It typically happens spontaneously, but it can happen from vigorous CPR, from intubation after a surgery, related to some type of trauma, mechanical ventilation, and sometimes a CF patient will have it. A chest x-ray will show the air pocket. If the air pocket's big enough, it can impede the ability of the lungs to completely expand and contract. We frequently have to reassess this patient. Keep hemostats and IV, or the Vaseline gauze at the bedside, because you may have to do a chest tube. And if there is a chest tube inserted, you're gonna have that there as well, because you may have to clamp off the tube that goes to the little back at the side of the bed. I have seen that done, y'all. There was a doctor came in, his patient was in distress. We had everything at the bedside. I was a student when it happened, okay? And y'all, do y'all know Sharon Walker? She was our instructor, okay? And she just retired this week and moved to Florida. Anyway, she was there with us, and we go in, and this doctor that was really known for just, you know, wild and crazy acts at the bedside comes in. He sees the patient in distress. He, like, pulls the covers down, whips the gown up, pokes the hemostats in, and opens them up and feeds into the chest tube. And we're like, all of us are like, as it happens, it was that fast. The patient went from crashing and burning and gasping for air and turning purple to pink and healthy. And wow, that's, you know, they never even reacted to the fact that they actually literally just poked a hole in his side. It was awful. Lots of bleeding involved. All right, and now on to chronic respiratory disorders. Allergic rhinitis, okay? And that is so very common, okay? It's associated with other things that you'll see, like atopic dermatitis and asthma. So atopic dermatitis in a kid, you're gonna typically see it in the flexural folds of their skin. We'll talk about skin in another day, but this is where you're gonna see it, right here in the elbows for the most part. If you walk into an exam room and you've got a kid sitting in front of you, and the first thing you notice is this rash in their arm, the next thing you're gonna think is, does this kid have asthma, okay? Because it is all associated. It is two different kinds, perennial, and that's just persistent throughout the year. That's usually related to indoor allergens, and they're listed here, the pet dander, cockroaches, and mold. Seasonal is usually outdoor allergies. It's related to different pollens, trees, weeds, fungi, and mold. The complications of allergic rhinitis, think about that. If you have prolonged excess mucus production, swollen airways from reaction to the allergens, it can turn into a sinus infection and otitis. The patho of this, the IgE binds to mast cells, releasing histamines and leukotrienes. Y'all know the leukotriene inhibitor, which one it is. There's only one out there, singular, monoleucast. Y'all don't have to know that. The symptoms, this is watery rhinitis or rhinorrhea with nasal itching and sneezing. Sometimes you'll have eye involvement, and that's that watery, itchy, red, runny eyes. people of all ages, the kids especially, will have a nasal crease. The nasal crease goes across the nose this way, okay? And it is from the nasal solute. Look at me and I'll demonstrate. They are wiping their nose. It itches and it's runny and they're constantly rubbing their nose in just exactly that direction. You do that often enough, you got the nasal crease right here, okay? And so you see a nasal crease on anybody and you say to yourself, I've got allergies, you know? You'll be surprised the things that you start picking up on once you've kind of been exposed to this and you see it for the first time, then you're gonna really be kind of aware of it. There's a chart there that you can take a look at in your book. So this is a little bit more on the allergic rhinitis. If they do have the red-rimmed watery eyes, they may have allergic shiners, okay? So they're gonna look like they've been on a three-day drunk, you know? Like their eyes are gonna be all purplish and swollen at the bottom. They're turbinates. Those are the speed bumps in the nose, okay? They will be boggy and kind of pale, like mother-of-pearl colored. What did I describe it here as? Bluish gray, gray or blue in color. The rhinorrhea, the discharge from their nose is gonna be clear and watery. They will have that nasally sound to their voice. Wheeziness, not uncommon. The type of test that you can do for them is the RAST, the R-A-S-T. That is the allergy testing that you'll see done. It's usually to identify the triggers so that you can do trigger avoidance or you can initiate desensitization, okay? And it depends on, you know, I mean, if you're a great outdoors person and you just wanna go hiking and, you know, canoeing and bike riding and be outside all the time, and you're just miserable, then it's definitely worth being desensitized. They do that to different foods as well. It's initially started in a allergy immunology office at a big complex. Y'all think LSU. This is not something you wanna do in Ringgold, okay? Because if that child has a reaction to the allergy shot that you've just given them, how many people are there to help rescue? You want this started and done for the first couple of months in a clinical setting, and they will get allergy shots for as much as a year and a half. And it's usually about three times a week. So trigger avoidance is important. They will suggest nasal washing, nasal corticosteroids, so think, you know, nasal spray, oral antihistamines, leukotriene inhibitors, and decongestants. And finally, oh, time is going good. What slide number are we on? 52. All right, so asthma. It is the most common childhood illness. About 7 million American kids have it at any given time. It is chronic inflammation of the airway. DO is just disorder. Airway hyper-responsiveness. You know how I like to describe hyper-responsiveness. Say that, I don't know, how many of y'all are parents? Okay, but you're the parent driving and the kid in the back seat says, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? It doesn't take long for you to just kind of be a little irritated, right? And to just snap and say, we'll get there when we get there, okay? That's kind of being hyper-responsive, okay? So this is an inflammation in the airway that is chronic and ongoing. And so it doesn't take much for them to go from their normal baseline status to real distress. They do have edema in their lung tissue and airways. They have excess mucus production. It goes from mild intermittent to daily symptoms. The more susceptible, they are more susceptible to bacterial infections and viral respiratory infections. Why would that be? They've got the perfect environment for a germ to live, right? Germs love warm, moist, and dark, okay? The complications can be as much as status asthmaticus and respiratory failure. So there is an inflammatory process that takes place. It's a true cascade. That's discussed in your book, but it begins with the mast cells, goes to inflammatory mediators, eosinophils, then neutrophil production, and then the neutrophils migrate to the airways. And they do cause airway injury. This causes prolonged airway constriction. It says constriction, but it's constriction. Increased mucus production, decreased mucociliary function. So you think about the little tiny hairs that line the airways that are supposed to move things that we come in contact with that our body doesn't like out of the airway. They're no longer functioning. That also predisposes you to infection. Let's see. It increases smooth muscle activity in the airways. So, you know, you've got your different types of muscle, and in the airway, it is smooth muscle, and it increases the activity there. It is reversible in most cases. Untreated or undertreated asthma leads to airway remodeling, and that is due to repeated asthma exacerbations that lead to irreversible structural damage in the lungs. And that is something you see. It's really unfortunate that especially kids are not real good perceivers of their trouble. And they of course do not report it. No kid wants to be sick ever. The first symptoms in a kid a lot of times is when they fall behind when they're playing. And they just kind of can't quite keep up with their friends. And a lot of times it's not really discovered until they get to the point of competing in sports in school. And I had a kid one time that came in that actually the coach was kind of after him because he couldn't keep up when they would do the sprints, running back and forth and running back and forth, and he didn't know he had asthma. And so as we sat there and started talking about it and kind of discovered that he did have that pattern of potentially having asthma. And so we actually tried an inhaler and got him out there running, and he could keep up. So it does make a difference. But a lot of times parents are in denial too, because you know, they want their kid to be fine. You know, my kid's fine, everything's fine. Identify and avoid triggers, because asthma is most of the time triggered by allergens. Control environmental factors. Control inflammation. So once again, you're going to be using bronchodilators. Probably inhale corticosteroids as well. They use the step up and step down. You only want to do as much as it takes. But so you step it up to where you have control. And then once you've maintained control for a certain period of time, you'll back it off by stepping back down. If they you know, rebound and have increased symptoms, then you'll step it back up again. SABA and LABA, that's a short-acting bronchoagonist. Inhaled corticosteroids. So there's a difference in using your inhaler as a control medication and a rescue inhaler. So just like we were talking about the sponge that you put in the bucket and it absorbed, albuterol is that medication that we're talking about that is absorbed. And if they use that inhaler on an everyday basis, that's okay, but it's not ideal. So if they're having to use it every day, we don't have very good control. So they will use a steroid to gain control so that they only have to use the albuterol if they really need it. There is exercise-induced asthma. The book suggests that they warm up longer and slower and only use the inhaler if they really need it to. That's not truly the advice. Usually you do use the inhaler prior to exercise. They will have a history of a nighttime cough that's usually non-productive. They'll get short of breath and feel tight in their chest. If they wheeze, and that's very common, they'll usually have a history of the seasonal allergies and atopic dermatitis once again. They'll have most likely one parent or both that have asthma as well. So on the physical exam, we're going to just take a good look at them. Do they look okay? Are they nice and healthy pink? Do they seem to have any kind of increase in the work of breathing? Are they head bobbing, tripod sitting? Do they seem anxious? Are they lethargic? Do they have an audible wheeze, meaning that you can hear it without even listening with your stethoscope? In some cases, you'll see a barrel chest. I'm not sure if I included a picture of that or not. Let's see. No. A barrel chest is when the distance from the front to the back is the same as the distance from side to side. You think about your own chest, you're about 2-to-1, right? In a barrel chest, it's even. That's something that once they develop that never goes away. So we will auscultate and percuss. Wheezing is the hallmark sign. They'll have some coarseness, and sometimes they will be diminished, but that's very rare. In severe cases, you might not hear anything. Once again, they're so tight that there's no air moving past to make that sound. And so you give them the nebulizer treatment, they sound worse. the diagnostics that we can use here. Once again, your pulse ox is a great tool. It's so non-invasive and just so easy to do. Just pop the little, you know, monitor on the finger, and it's always a good indication. A chest x-ray, ABGs, PFTs, which is pulmonary function test. Y'all might hear that called spirometry as well. Getting a peak flow, and RAS testing. And that's the allergy testing we talked about earlier. The goal is to restore effective breathing patterns and oxygenation. We're going to teach the patient and the family about the chronicity of the disease, because it doesn't go away. The importance of using the maintenance medicines and exacerbations, like when they have a worsening of their asthma, is not considered an acute illness. So a little wrap up on asthma. Pay attention to your child. Have a written action plan at school. Make sure that there is a rescue inhaler available to them at school. The school nurse, of course, has to know about your child's condition, but they also need to be an expert on how to treat it when there's a problem. So you need to make sure that the patient and the parent knows how to use whatever device it is that you're giving them. And I wish I had my bag of stuff. You know, I used to have every last inhaler device that you could have, because they're all different. Some of them you have to shake before you inhale it. Some of them you put them all the way in your mouth. Some of them you, you know, just touch to the edge of your lips. And some of them, if you shake it, then the medicine's gone before you ever put it to your mouth. And some of these, the dry powders, like the Advair Discus, you know, the purple disc that you see advertised on TV, if you open that thing and you go to shake it to use it, the medicine is gone. And people think that they're not getting any medication when they use that. So in demonstration of that, I've taken out actually a black piece of paper or black something or other and wasted one dose by putting it on the piece of paper. I mean, it is a couple of little speckles on there. That's it. That's how much medicine is delivered in one dose. And remember, y'all, I think I said this earlier, inhalers are dosed in micrograms. That's a thousandth of a milligram. So you can safely use micrograms for the inhalers for a long time. Miss Hill, join us.
Briefly.
Okay.
Long way there, little sight and badges. I'm just going to lay
them
here.
Oh, yeah.
And ask them to pick them up when they're finished.
Okay, so all of y'all that are going to Willis-Knighton,
yeah.
Have your badge.
Okay. That have had previous badges, she just reprinted them, so there they are. So check and see if you're here. If it's not, check with me afterwards, okay?
Oh my gosh, when you get that badge and put it on, you're going to feel official, okay? So let's get back on this asthma. We do need to make sure that they know how to use it and that they know what to expect when they use the dose, okay? How's it going to affect them, but how will they know if they got a dose? That's always important, because if they don't think they're getting anything from it, they're going to think, you know, why am I even bothering? And they're going to, you know, not use it. Also, you have to think about corticosteroids that you're inhaling into your mouth. And what do steroids do? Come on, somebody. It feeds fungus, okay? So you get yeast in your mouth, right? Or in your airways. And so we have to always teach them to rinse their mouth out when they use an inhaler that is a steroid. And so the best way to teach that is, this is gonna be a maintenance medicine and they'll use it twice a day, most cases. And just do it when they're brushing their teeth. So they do their medicine and then they brush their teeth and then it's gone. We use a peak flow, so you know, okay? So that is a peak flow monitor. And like I said, children are very poor perceivers of their asthma. And we can use that peak flow to establish what their pulmonary function is as they walk out the door every morning to go to school, okay? And you may say, wow, you're really down today. You might kind of, you know, just not play so hard at PE or something like that, and make sure the nurse knows that your peak flow is down. So it's just a little device, and similar to the way an incentive spirometer is. But when you blow on this one, so you're trying to blow as much as you possibly can in the first second, so that's peak flow, you'll actually put a range on there. And you'll see in your book there's written asthma action plans. You need to have a written asthma action plan that has what your typical peak flow is on it, okay? Parents and the patients are in denial. Kids will hide it because they fear that you're not gonna let them go somewhere and do something, okay? So they're always gonna pretend. And I can tell you right now, working in that clinic, you'd have these kids watch my chest, y'all, like, and they wouldn't be sucking any air in. They would intentionally, they moved their chest like they were taking a big deep breath, but they weren't breathing at all because they were worried to death you were going to hear them wheeze, okay? And then you were going to say something about their wheezing and they couldn't go somewhere. As they hit the school age years, they can be responsible for their own inhaler use. They can determine when they need it. You as parent need to be aware that they're using it. You know, sometimes you'd have somebody come in the clinic and you say, well, how often are you using it? And they'd say, well, how often have you had to get up during the night and take an inhaler treatment? And it was surprising how few times parents were aware of what their kids were doing. So I think this is probably our last disease process, cystic fibrosis. There might be tracheo, something. I'm trying to remember. There's a few more maybe. So cystic fibrosis. Y'all, this is a BDD. It's a big deal with another D added in, okay? It is autosomal recessive. There's 30,000 people in the United States that have it right now, and it is mostly kids. The CFTR gene is malformed, and that's usually Delta F508 is the most common malformation that there is. At this time, newborn screens in every state in the United States screens for CF. That was not the case back when I worked in CF. We were the only CF center in the state of Louisiana after the Hurricane Katrina. CF is the most common debilitating childhood disease in European children. That's the white population. You do see it in other populations, but it's much less prevalent. The median life expectancy now is 39.3. That goes up all the time. When I worked there, it's 23.7 years, something like that. So the rate of life expectancy has increased at almost the rate of time passage, you see? So people diagnosed today, their life expectancy should be the same as the rest of us, okay? Because of the new treatments that they've discovered through the years. CF complications, hemoptysis, pneumothorax, bacterial colonization, that's the big one right there. Bacteria is bad, y'all. Cor pulmonale, that's increased pressure around the heart, which causes problems. Intestinal obstructions are very common. They have GERD. CFRD is CF-related diabetes. Liver failure, portal hypertension, and decreased fertility. You have to think, everything they have is thick and sticky, wherever it is in the body. If it's the mucus, if it's the lining of the stomach, if it's the intestines, if it's the, you know, cervical area, everything is thick and sticky. So this is talking about PATH, and I just thought that was kind of cute. So there is a lot to consider with CF. It is a generalized dysfunction of the exocrine gland. And y'all remember that. It is exocrine, not endocrine. The chloride function affects water transport, thus it has thick, sticky secretions in sweat glands, the GI tract, respiratory, and the other exocrine tissues. It alters electrolytes. It causes dehydration. It causes pancreatic insufficiency because that pancreatic duct that is making pancreatic enzymes, they never leave, okay? So we have to help them with digesting food by giving them pancreatic enzymes. They have malabsorption of fats, protein and carb too, but the big thing is fats. They have very poor growth. These are gonna be your little bitty kids. They're gonna be in the less than 5th percentile most of the time. They have bulky, stinky stools, okay? And I'm not kidding when I say that. It's awful. They also can experience mucus plugs in their airways, and semen and cervical environment are also affected. So most of the time, although they produce sperm, the sperm never leaves, and so they are unable to reproduce. CF management, we're gonna minimize pulmonary complications, maximize lung function, and prevent infection. Then we also have to be really big in promoting growth and development, remember that. The treatment regimen, CPT, that vest that you see in the picture, is the most common form of CPT that is done. Those treatments usually are a couple of times a day. They last about 20 to 30 minutes. Everyone is individualized, so that's why there's a range there. They all get the Pulmozyme, which is a recombinant human DNase, is how we all say that, Bronchodilators are the anti-inflammatory agents. They sometimes have nebulized antibiotics. They will have very high calorie, high protein diets, and sometimes you'll have to supplement. And it, you know, you can breastfeed a CF baby, but they may actually need extra calories, so they would have to have a supplement as well. Excuse me. Lung transplant is also a potential for these kids. I've seen that quite a bit, and you give them new lungs and they are perfectly healthy. So it's really pretty good. So you do have to have kind of a plan. Did we lose our Natchitoches group? Natchitoches, y'all still there with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we just lost our screen up here, but that's okay. There we go. So really now the diagnosis is made through the newborn screen. But here you go. This is some of the diagnostic things that you can use. They will taste salty if you want to taste their skin. They may have a meconium ileus at birth, and they may have some abdominal pain, gassy, bulky, greasy stools, poor weight gain despite eating like a horse. That's one thing. When you have that underweight kid and, you know, mom brings them in and you say, well, tell me about their appetite. And she's like, they eat like a horse. Well, you know, my radar always went up after having worked in that, because that's the first thing you think. If they're eating like a horse and they can't put on a single pound, is it CF? They will have a chronic recurrent cough in most cases. It depends on which gene mutation you have as to what your symptoms are going to be, because sometimes it is more GI than it is respiratory. When they're sick, always ask about their appetite, their activity level, their respiratory status, and if they've had any kind of recent pulmonary infection. So the physical exam, of course, you're going to look at the general appearance once again, look at their work of breathing or accessory muscle use. Are they barrel-chested? Are they small and thin for their age? Do they have a cough? And do they have clubbing? You will see clubbing in CF patients. Not all of them. Remember, it varies. I'll have to compare this to, do you have a mode of transportation? Okay. So most people can answer yes. Well, some people it may be a moped, okay? And some people it may be the 757 jet, okay? So there's a wide variety in CF. It can be not all that bad, but it can actually be horrible. Tachycardia sometimes is present, and then you can have a gallop if you have core pulmonale. So you see the sweaty ring in that hat? That is something that you would very commonly see with a CF kid. So the diagnostic test, if they have greater than 60 on the sweat chloride test, it is a positive, okay? And they're actually gonna put the gauze covered by plastic on both arms, and they'll do numbers on both arms, okay? Either one of them high is an indication. But I can tell you this, they say in the book less than 50, they're not concerned. I can promise you this, that's not the case. If we had anything even in the teens, we would go ahead and run the gene testing, okay? And try to detect it that way. Of course, once again, using the pulse ox, the chest x-ray, pulmonary function testing is important, and like I said, genetic testing. On CF management, we're gonna try to minimize complications, promote growth and development, facilitate coping and adjust it. This is one of those tough ones where you've got this child that you're brand new newborn baby, and they're telling you that you have a child that's gonna have a life-limiting, life-shortening disease process that is very high burdensome. It takes hours a day to take care of a CF child, hours. Maintain a patent airway with CPT. They also have flutter valve devices now called a PEPT. And older kids will use that, teenagers can. They expire into this and it is resisting. So as they breathe out, it opens the airways. CPT uses percussion, vibration, postural drainage, and it's done several times a day. It usually is done with the vest 20 to 30 minutes at a time, and it's during or just right after a handheld nebulizer treatment with albuterol. And it's always done before meals, y'all. Can you imagine putting that vest on after you've had a meal and it's sitting there jiggling your belly? We need to prevent infection. The burden of disease is high on this one. Like I said, hours a day. You've got all your different treatments. You have to do the pancreatic enzymes with every single thing that goes in their mouth, okay? And so a lot of times, you know, they're going to look at that and kind of they're judging on how much fat is in that to, as to how many enzymes they need to take. The hospitalizations are lengthy. It's usually 2 weeks at a time, and they call it a tune-up. They're going in for a tune-up. Okay, so pancreatic insufficiency varies. We do have to adjust the enzymes. The high-fat meals need more. If necessary, you can open the capsules and sprinkle them on applesauce. You are limited on what you can put them in because they are an enzyme that can be, like, you can't put it on ice cream, okay? I think you can't put it on peanut butter. Let's just stick with applesauce. We know you can do that, okay? They have embarrassing bathroom issues. They need A, D, E, and K. Those are the fat-soluble vitamins. You can look at your book there on 1450 to show CPT that's done by hand, you know, cupped hand. The regimen does require a lot of time. There are feelings of fear and isolation. You can imagine that kid doesn't have enough time to go out and play outside because they're sitting inside getting their CPT. We have to encourage the families to embrace this as a new way of living rather than a disease. They can and usually do become independent adults that have rewarding work and relationships. All people with CF will be carriers or donors of the defective gene. And until it became part of the newborn screen, the way that you found out that you had CF was, or that your child did, was after they had developed symptoms. But then that's how you found out that you were the carrier, and it has to be the mom and the dad. It's not one or the other. Because of its recessiveness, it has to come from both. I believe I'm telling you right on that. Okay, let's move on to apnea, okay? And this is a pretty simple disease process that can take just a couple minutes to go over. It is an absence of respirations for greater than 20 seconds. They may or may not have bradycardia at the same time. It is an life-threatening event. Life-threatening event is the LTE. But it is not a contributor to SIDS. So if you have bradycardia or bradypnea, it is not related to SIDS. It may occur at any age due to respiratory distress, meaning that we all could suffer from it. Think about that. That's very true. But it is more common in preemies and newborns, and it is called central, meaning that it comes from the central nervous system. Okay? Some potential causes for apnea are hyperthermia, hypoglycemia, hyperbilirubinemia. I stuttered over that one, right? Possible related to anemia. They haven't made a direct link, but they think that it is related. The treatment is to stimulate, not shake, the baby, okay? You may have to give rescue breaths. And so if we're in a hospitalized setting and we are afraid that this is gonna happen, what are we gonna have at the bedside? The good old AMBU bag, okay? Medications are caffeine and theophylline. That's why you've got your little cup of coffee there with your apnea. So the way I remind myself which medication, because caffeine's easy to remember, but remembering theophylline is not. So I call it caffeine and theophylline. Okay? Does that make sense? So use of a monitor is commonly done in the house. It frequently goes off when there is no apnea that's occurring, just because it loses the, you know, just like on your pulse ox, it loses connectivity and it goes off, it wakes the baby up. And so, believe it or not, noncompliance is kind of a common issue. Parents will get kind of lulled into that sense of nothing's happened, you know, it goes off all the time, nothing's ever happened, and we're just gonna have a nice quiet night tonight. That baby needs its sleep. They'll justify it like that. So tracheostomy, this is an artificial airway opening. There's several different reasons to use it. Sometimes it is gonna be permanent. Most of the time it is temporary. Kids use the type that is inserted into them as an uncuffed, flexible tube. Complications after surgery include hemorrhage, air entry around it, pulmonary edema. They may experience anatomic damage, meaning scar tissue, and respiratory arrest. So scar tissue is the one that, that's why they have so much better of a apparatus here than what adults do, because of the fact that they're growing, number one, they do need some flexibility in that too. Make the child, it does make the child prone to infections because you've got an opening there in the respiratory tract. Cellulitis at the site is common, granulation around the insertion site, that causes the scar tissue. It can also affect their larynx, so it can damage their ability to speak later in life. It says, why do they need the trach to begin with? What is their general appearance? Are they nice and pink? Do they have a lot of secretions? Are their breath sounds equal? And are they clear? So they need increased humidification. Their airways get dry very quickly. They do need frequent suctioning as well. And you're gonna suction the trach, okay? You keep the head of the bed elevated and do trach care every 8. And you don't trade out the trach. You know, you always make sure you have an extra one at the bedside in case you need to, or in case it pops out. And that does happen. All right, you guys, that's the end of that presentation. Let me see, how do I quit sharing?